the Tuscarora, who in turn had sold him as a slave to the Mohawk farther north. We didn't want to risk him ever coming back to trouble Brianna, aye? Only then...
He swallowed, reliving in memory both the terror of his asking Brianna to marry him and the utter horror when Cousin Bree had drawn a picture of the man she loved, the man she was waiting for, and the strong, dark features of the man they had given to the Mohawk sprang into view.
"You asked thy cousin to marry thee? Did thee want to?"
She looked wary. He supposed she must be thinking that he went about proposing to every third or fourth woman he met, and hastened to correct this impression.
Well, Brianna's a... Well, I didn't have mine, Ken. We'd have got on fine, and she, well... I mean, no, not exactly, he added hurriedly, seeing Rachel's graceful brows draw together.
The truth was that he'd been 17, and Brianna several years older. She'd terrified him, but the thought of bedding her had... He choked that thought off as though it were a venomous snake.
"It was Uncle Jamie's idea," he said, with as much an air of casual dismissal as could be assumed on short notice. He lifted one shoulder. "To give the bairn a name, aye? I said I would, for the family honour."
"The family honour," she repeated, giving him a fishy look. "To be sure, but then..."
"But then we found it was Roger Mack. He'd taken back his own name of Mackenzie, is why we didn't recognize him. That we'd given to the Indians by mistake. And so we went to retrieve him," he said quickly.
By the time he'd finished explaining all the events that had culminated in his volunteering to take the place of a Mohawk killed during Roger's rescue, the washing of his body in the river, the Mohawk women scrubbing him with sand to remove the last trace of his white blood, the plucking of his hair, and the tattoos, he thought his marriage to Emily might seem only one more picturesque detail. But of course it didn't. He stopped dead, realizing suddenly that the conversation was about to become even stickier than he'd thought. He glanced at her apprehensively, heart beating in his throat and ears. But she was still looking back, the pinkness round her mouth showing more vividly because she'd gone a little pale, but looking, clear and steady.
"I wasn't a virgin when I wed," he blurted.
The eyebrow went up again.
"Really, I'm not quite sure what to ask," she said,
examining him in the way he'd seen his Auntie Claire appraise some horrible growth, fascinated rather than repelled, but with a firm air of deciding exactly how best to deal with the offending bit. He hoped fervently she didn't mean to cut him out of her life like a wart, or amputate him like a gangrenous toe.
"I'll tell you anything you want to know," he said bravely. "Anything."
"A generous offer," she said, "and one I shall accept. But I think I must offer thee the same accommodation. Thee does not wish to ask whether I am virgin?"
His mouth fell open, and her shoulders shook briefly. "You're not," he croaked.
"No, I am," she assured him, still quivering with the effort not to laugh. "But why should thee assume it?"
"Why?"
He felt the blood rise in his face.
"Because anyone who looked at you would know ye on the instant for a virtuous woman," he concluded, with a sense of relief at having found a reasonable term.
"I might have been raped," she pointed out. "That would not mean I was not virtuous, would it?"
No, I suppose not."
He knew that a good many folk would think a raped woman was not virtuous, and Rachel knew that. He was on the verge of becoming completely confused, and she knew that too. He could see her taking pains not to laugh. He squared his shoulders and gave a great sigh, then met her eyes directly.
"Do you want to hear about every woman whose bed I've shared? Because I'll tell you, if so. I've never taken a woman unwillingly, though they were mostly whores. I'm no pots, though," he assured her. "You should ken that."
She considered that for a moment.
"I think I need not know the details," she said finally. "But should we ever meet a woman thee has bedded, I wish to know it."
"Thee does not mean to continue fornicating with prostitutes once we are wed, though, does thee?"
"No."
"Good," she said,
but rocked back a little on the log, hands linked around her knees, holding his gaze.
"I do wish to hear more about thy wife, Emily."
He could feel the warmth of her leg, her body, close beside him. She hadn't moved away from him when he'd said about sleeping with whores. The silence grew around them, and a jay called somewhere in the wood beyond.
"We loved each other," he said at last, softly, eyes on the ground. "And I wanted her. I could talk to her. Then, at least."
Rachel drew breath, but didn't say anything. He took his courage in his hands and looked up. Her face was carefully expressionless, her eyes intent on his face.
"I dinna ken how to see it," he said. "It wasna the same way I want you. But I dinna mean to make it sound as though Emily didn't matter to me. She did," he added, very low-voiced, and glanced down again.
"And she does?"
Rachel asked quietly, after a long pause. After a longer one, he nodded, swallowing.
"But," he said,
and stopped, searching for the way to go on, because now they were coming to the most perilous part of his confession, the thing that might make Rachel stand up and walk away, dragging his heart behind her through the rocks and brush.
"But," she said, and her voice was gentle.
"The Mohawk," he began, and had to stop for a breath. "It's the woman's choice about being married. If a woman should take against her husband for some reason, if he beats her, or he's a lazy sot, or smells too bad when he farts."
He stole a glance and saw the corner of her mouth twitch, which heartened him a little.
"She puts his things out of the longhouse, and he has to go back to live with the unmarried men, or find another woman who'll have him at her fire, or leave altogether."
"And Emily put you out?"
She sounded both startled and a bit indignant. He gave her a wee smile in return.
"Aye, she did. Not because I beat her, though. Because of the bairns."
He felt the tears come to his eyes and clenched his hands in frustration on his knees.
Damn, he'd sworn to himself that he wouldn't weep.
Either she'd think he made a show of his grief to win her sympathy, or she'd see too deep. He wasn't ready, but he had to tell her. He'd started this on purpose to tell her. She had to know.
"I couldna give her children," he blurted. "The first, we had a wee daughter, born too early, who died. I called her Ishabel."
He wiped the back of his hand viciously under his nose, swallowing his pain.
"After that, she, Emily, she got wee child again. And again. And when she lost the third, her heart toward me died with it."
Rachel made a small sound, but he didn't look at her. Couldn't. Just sat hunched on the log like a toadstool, shoulders drawn up around his ears, and eyes blurred with the tears he couldn't shed. A small, warm hand settled on his.
"And your heart?" she asked. "Yours died too?"
He closed his hand on hers and nodded, and then just breathed for a bit, holding onto her hand until he could speak again without his voice breaking.
"The Mohawk think that the man's spirit fights with the woman's when they lie together, and she will na get with child unless his spirit can conquer hers."
"Oh, I see," Rachel said softly. "So she blamed you?"
He shrugged.
"I canna say she was wrong."
He turned a little on the log to look at her directly.
"And I canna say that it would be different with us. But I did ask Auntie Claire.
and she told me about things in the blood.
Well, perhaps you should ask her to explain it. I wouldn't make a decent job of it.
But the end of it was that she thought it might be different with another woman. That I maybe could give you bairns, I mean.
He only realized that Rachel had been holding her breath when she let it out, a sigh that brushed his cheek.
Do you... he began.
But she had risen a little into him, and she kissed him gently on the mouth, then held his head against her breast and took the end of her kerchief and wiped his eyes, and then her own.
"Oh, Ian," she whispered, "I do love thee."
Chapter 17
Freedom.
Grey passed another interminable, though less eventful, day, broken only by watching Colonel Smith write dispatches, which he did at a furious rate, quills scratching with the sound of a scuttling cockroach. This bit of imagery did nothing for Grey's digestion, which, in the aftermath of intoxication, hadn't dealt all that well with the cold, grease-caked corn dodger and burnt acorn coffee he'd been given for breakfast. In spite of physical infelicity, and an uncertain future, though, he found himself surprisingly cheerful. Jamie Fraser was alive, and he, John, wasn't married. Given those two marvellous facts, the dubious prospects of escape and the much higher probability of being hanged seemed only mildly concerning. He settled himself to wait with what grace he could, sleeping as much as his head allowed, or singing softly to himself, a practice that caused Smith to hunch his shoulders up around his ears and scratch faster. Messengers came and went with great frequency. If he hadn't already known that the Continentals were not only moving but preparing for a fight, it would have been clear to him within an hour. The hot air was burdened with the scent of molten lead and the whine of a sharpening wheel, and the camp had a sense of rising urgency that any soldier would have felt at once. Smith made no attempt to keep him from hearing what was said by and to the messengers and the subalterns. Clearly he didn't expect the information gained to be of any use to Grey. Well, neither did Grey, to be honest. Toward the evening, the tent's door was darkened by a slender female form, though, and Grey raised himself to a sitting position, careful of his tender head, because his heart had begun to beat strongly again, and it made his eye throb. His niece Dotty was in sober Quaker garb, but the soft blue of much-laundered indigo was surprisingly flattering to her English rose colouring, and she was in amazing fine looks. She nodded to Colonel Smith and set down her tray upon his desk before glancing over his shoulder at the prisoner. Her blue eyes widened in shock, and Grey grinned at her over the colonel's shoulder. Denzel must have warned her, but he supposed he must look a literal fright with a grotesquely swollen face and a fixed and glaring crimson eye. She blinked and swallowed, then said something low-voiced to Smith, with a brief questioning gesture in Grey's direction. He nodded impatiently, already taking up his own spoon, and she wrapped a thick rag around one of the steaming cans on the tray and came across to Grey's cot.
"Dear me, friend," she said mildly, "thee seems much injured. Dr. Hunter says thee may eat as much as is comfortable, and he will attend thee later to put a dressing on your eye."
"Thank you, young woman," he said gravely, and, glancing over her shoulder to be sure Smith's back was turned, nodded at her.
"Is it squirrel stew?"
"Possum, friend," she said. "Here, I brought thee a spoon. The stew is boiling. Be careful."
Putting herself carefully between him and Smith, she placed the rag-wrapped can between his knees and rapidly touched the rags, then the links of his fetters, her eyebrows raised. A horn spoon was produced from the pocket tied at her waist, and a knife with it, which was slipped under his pillow, quick as any conjurer could have managed it. Her pulse was beating fast in her throat, and perspiration gleamed at her temples. He touched her hand once, softly, and picked up the spoon.
"Thank you," he said again. "Tell Dr. Hunter I look forward to seeing him again."
The rope was horsehair, and the knife dull, and it was very late,
and with innumerable small cuts stinging his hands and fingers, that Grey rose cautiously from the cot. His heart was pounding. He could feel it thumping briskly behind his injured eye, and hoped the eye itself wasn't going to explode under the impact. He bent and picked up the tin chamber pot and used it. Smith was a very sound sleeper, thank God. If he roused at all, he would hear the familiar noise, be reassured, and, presumably, fall back asleep, subconsciously ignoring any further small noises as being Grey resettling himself. Smith's breathing didn't change. He had a small buzzing snore like a bee working in a flower, a tidy, busy sound that Grey found mildly comical. He lowered himself to his knees, slowly, between the cot and Smith's pallet, fighting a momentary insane impulse to kiss Smith on the ear. He had sweet, small ears, very pink. This vanished in an instant, and he crept on hands and knees to the edge of the tent. He'd threaded the rags and the gauze with which Denzel Hunter had packed his eye through the links of his fetters, but still moved with the utmost caution. Being caught would be bad for him. It would be disastrous for Hunter and Dottie. He'd been listening intently to the sentries for hours. There were two guarding the colonel's tent, but he was fairly sure that both were presently near the front flap, warming themselves at the fire. Hot as the day had been, this late at night, the forest's blood ran cold. So did his. He lay down and squirmed as quickly as he could under the edge of the tent, clinging to the canvas to minimize any shaking of the tent itself. Though he'd taken pains to jerk on his rope every so often through the evening, so that any shifting of the structure might be put down to his normal movements. Out. He allowed himself one deep gulp of air, fresh, cold, and leafy, then rose, clutching the padded fetters close against his body, and walked as silently as possible away from the tent. He mustn't run. He had had a short, sharp, whispered argument with Hunter during the latter's evening visit, seizing the brief moment when Smith had left the tent to visit the latrine. Hunter had insisted that Grey hide in his wagon. He was going into Philadelphia. Everyone knew that. There would be no suspicion, and Grey would be safe from patrols. Grey appreciated Hunter's desire to rescue him, but he couldn't possibly put the doctor, let alone Dottie, at risk. And risk it would be. In Smith's place, the first thing he would do was prevent anyone from leaving. The second, search the camp and everything in it. "There's no time," Hunter had said, briskly tucking in the end of the bandage he had wrapped around Grey's head. "And he may be right." He glanced over his shoulder. Smith would be back any minute. "I'll leave a bundle of food and clothing in my wagon for thee. If thee chooses to make use of it, I'm glad. If not, God go with thee. Wait." Grey seized Hunter by the sleeve, making his fetters rattle. "How will I know which wagon is yours?" "Oh." Hunter coughed, seeming embarrassed. "It has, sign painted on the tailboard. Dottie purchased it from..." "Now, you must take care, friend," he said abruptly, raising his voice. "Eat generously but slowly. Take no alcohol, and be careful in moving. Do not stand up too quickly." Colonel Smith came in, and seeing the doctor present, came over to inspect the patient himself. "Are you feeling better, Colonel?" he inquired politely. "Or are you still suffering from the need to burst into song? If so, might I suggest you do so now and get it out of your system before I retire for the night?" Hunter, who had of course heard Die Sommernacht the night before, made a small noise in his throat, but managed to take his leave without losing control. Grey grinned to himself, recalling Smith's glower, and imagining what the colonel might look like in a few hours when he woke to discover that his songbird had flown. He made his way around the edge of the camp, avoiding the picket lines of mules and horses, easy to detect by the smell of manure. The wagons were parked nearby. No artillery, he noted. The sky was overcast,
a sickle moon glimmering uneasily between racing clouds, and the air held the scent of impending rain. Fine. There were worse things than being wet and cold, and rain would hamper pursuit if anyone discovered his absence before daylight. No abnormal sounds from the camp behind him. None he could hear above the noise of his own heart and breathing. Hunter's wagon was easy to find, even in the flickering dark. He'd thought by sign that the doctor meant a name, but it was one of the barn signs that some of the German immigrants painted on their houses and sheds. He smiled when the clouds parted, revealing this one clearly, and he saw why Dottie had chosen it. It was a large circle in which two comical birds faced each other, beaks open in the manner of lovebirds. Distelfink. The word floated into his head. Someone, somewhere, had told him the name of that sort of bird, saying it was a symbol of good luck.
Good, he said under his breath, climbing up into the wagon. I'll need it.
He found the bundle under the seat where Hunter had told him, and took a moment to remove the silver buckles from his shoes, tying the flaps together instead with a length of leather lacing that had evidently been meant for his hair. He left the buckles tucked under the seat, put on the shabby coat, which smelled strongly of stale beer, and what he thought was old blood, and peered at the knitted cap, which held two corn dodgers, an apple, and a small canteen of water. Turning back the edge of the hat, he read by the fitful moonlight, "Liberty or Death," in bold white letters. He wasn't headed in any particular direction. Even had the sky been clear, he wasn't sufficiently familiar as to be able to chart his direction by the stars. His only goal was to get as far away from Smith as possible without running into another militia company or a patrol of Continentals. Once the sun was up, he could orient himself. Hunter had told him that the main road lay south-southwest of the camp, about 4 miles away. What the public might make of a man strolling down the main road in fetters was another question, but not one he needed to answer just now. After walking for an hour or so, he found a sheltered spot among the roots of an enormous pine tree, and taking out the knife, hacked off his hair as best he could. He stuffed the shorn locks well back under a root, rubbed his hands in the dirt, and then applied them vigorously to hair and face before donning his Phrygian cap. Thus suitably concealed, he heaped a thick blanket of fallen dry needles over himself, curled up, and went to sleep to the sound of pattering rain in the trees above. Once more, a free man. Chapter 18. Nameless, homeless, destitute, and very drunk indeed. Hot, dishevelled, and still thoroughly out of temper from his encounter with Richardson, William made his way back through the crowded streets. One more night in a decent bed, at least. Tomorrow he'd leave Philadelphia with the last few companies of the army following Clinton north, and leaving the remaining loyalists to fend for themselves. He was torn between relief and guilt at the thought, but had little energy left to consider them. He arrived at his billet to find that his orderly had deserted and had taken with him William's best coat, 2 pairs of silk stockings, a half-bottle of brandy, and the seed pearl-encrusted double miniature of William's mother, Geneva, and his other mother, her sister, Isabel. This was so far over the bloody limit of what could be borne that he didn't even swear. Merely sank down on the edge of the bed, closed his eyes, and breathed through clenched teeth until the pain in his stomach subsided. It left a raw-edged hollow. He'd had that miniature since he was born, was accustomed to bid it good night before he slept. Though since he'd left home, he did this silently. He told himself it didn't matter. He was unlikely to forget what his mother's looked like. There were other paintings, at home, at Hellwater. He remembered Mama Isabel, and he could see the traces of his real mother in his own face. Involuntarily, he glanced at the shaving mirror that hung on the wall. The orderly had somehow overlooked that in his flight, and felt the hollow inside him fill with hot tar. He no longer saw the curve of his mother's mouth, her dark, wavy chestnut hair. He saw instead the too long, knife-edged nose, the slanted eyes, and broad cheekbones. He stared at this blunt evidence of betrayal for an instant, then turned and stamped out. "Fuck the resemblance," he said, and slammed the door behind him. He didn't care where he was going, but within a few streets he ran into Lindsay and another couple of fellows he knew, all intent on making the most of their last evening in a semi-civilized city.
"Come along, young Ellesmere," Sandy said, collaring him firmly and shoving him down the street. "Let's make a few memories to see us through the long winter nights up north, eh?"
Some hours later, viewing the world through the bottom of a beer glass, William wondered rather blearily whether memories counted if you didn't remember them. He'd lost count some time ago of what and how many of what he'd drunk. He thought he'd lost one or two or three of the companions with whom he'd started the evening too, but couldn't swear to it. Sandy was still there, swaying in front of him, saying something, urging him to his feet. William smiled vaguely at the barmaid, fumbled in his pocket, and laid his last coin on the table. That was all right. He had more in his trunk, rolled up in his spare pair of stockings. He followed Sandy outside into a night that seized and clung, the hot air so thick that it was hard to breathe, clogged with the smell of horse droppings, human ordure, fish scales, wilted vegetables, and fresh-slaughtered meat. It was late and dark. The moon hadn't yet risen, and he stumbled over the cobbles, lurching into Sandy, a blacker smudge on the night before him. Then there was a door, a blur of light, and an enveloping hot scent of liquor and women, their flesh, their perfume, the smell more befuddling than the sudden light. A woman in a ribboned cap was smiling at him, greeting him. Too old to be a whore. He nodded amiably at her and opened his mouth, only to be mildly surprised by the fact that he'd forgotten how to talk. He closed his mouth and went on nodding. The woman laughed in a practiced way and guided him to a shabby wing chair where she deposited him as she might leave a parcel, to be called for later. He sat slumped in a daze for some time, the sweat running down his neck under his stock and dampening his shirt. There was a fire burning in a hearth near his legs, a small cauldron of rum punch steaming on the hob, and the scent of it made him queasy. He had the feeling that he was melting like a candle, but couldn't move without being sick. He shut his eyes. Sometime later, he slowly became aware of voices near him. He listened for a little, unable to make sense of any words, but feeling the flow vaguely soothing, like ocean waves. His stomach had settled now, and with his eyelids at half-mast, he gazed placidly at a shifting sand of light and shadow, pricked with bright colours, like darting tropical birds. He blinked a few times, and the colours shimmered into coherence, the hair and ribbons and white shifts of women, the red coats of infantry, the blue of an artilleryman moving among them. Their voices had given him the impression of birds, high and trilling, squawking now and then, or scolding like the mockingbirds who lived in the big oak near the plantation house at Mount Josiah. But it wasn't the women's voices that caught his attention. A pair of dragoons were lounging on the settee nearby, drinking rum punch and eyeing up the women. He thought they'd been talking for some time, but now he could make out the words. "Ever buggered a girl?" one of the dragoons was saying to his friend. The friend giggled and flushed, shook his head, murmured something that sounded like, "Too dear for my purse." "What you want?" "The girl that ate," said. The dragoon hadn't moved his gaze from the women across the room. He raised his voice just a little.
They clamp down, trying to get rid of you. But they can't.
William turned his head and looked at the man, repulsed, and making his disgust evident. The man ignored him. He seemed vaguely familiar, dark and heavy-featured, but no one William knew by name.
Then you take her hand and make her reach back and feel you. God, the squirmin'. Milk you like a dairymaid, she will.
The man laughed loudly, still staring across the room, and for the first time William looked to see the target of this brutish farrago. There were three women standing in a group, two in their shifts, the thin fabric moulded damply to their bodies, one in an embroidered petticoat. But it was plain to see who the dragoon's insinuations were meant for. The tallish one in the petticoat, who stood there with her fists clenched, glaring back at the dragoon, fit to burn a hole through his forehead. The madam was standing a little apart, frowning at the dragoon. Sandy had disappeared. The other men present were drinking and talking with four girls at the far end of the room. They hadn't heard this vulgar impertinence. The dragoon's friend was scarlet as his coat, between liquor, amusement, and embarrassment. The dark dragoon was flushed, too, a livid line across his heavy, stubbled jowls where they pressed against the leather of his stock. One hand plucked absently at the sweat-stained crotch of his moleskin breeches. He was having too much fun with his prey to cut the chase short, though.
Mind, you don't want one who's used to it. You want her tight.
He leaned forward a little, elbows on his knees, eyes intent on the tall girl.
But you don't want one who's never had it before, either. Better if she knows what's coming, eh?
His friend mumbled something indistinct, glanced at the girl, and hastily away. William looked back at the girl, too, and as she made a small involuntary movement, not quite a flinch, the candlelight glowed for an instant on the smooth crown of her head. Soft chestnut, with the gloss of a fresh conquer.
Jesus Christ.
Before he knew it, he was on his feet. He took two swaying paces to the madam's side, touched her shoulder politely, and when she turned a surprised face up to him, all her attention had been on the dragoon, a worried line between her brows, he said slowly, so as not to slur his words,
"I'll take that one, please. The tall girl, in the petticoat, for the night."
The madam's plucked eyebrows all but vanished into her cap. She looked quickly at the dragoon, who was still so fixed on his prey that he hadn't noticed William at all.
His friend had, though. He nudged the dragoon and muttered in his ear, "Eh? What's that?"
The man was already moving, scrambling to his feet. William groped hastily in his pocket, remembering too late that he was penniless.
"What's this, Madge?"
The dragoon was with them, dividing a glower between the madam and William. William straightened instinctively. He had 6 inches on the man, and squared up. The dragoon assessed his size and his age, and lifted the corner of his upper lip to show an eye-tooth.
"Arabella's mine, sir. I'm sure Madge will find another young lady to accommodate you."
"I am before you, sir,"
William said, and bowed, inclining his head a quarter inch, keeping a close eye on the cullion. Wouldn't put it past the filthy bugger to try to kick him in the balls. The look on his face, he wouldn't stick at it.
"He is, Captain Harkness," the madam said, quickly stepping between the men. "He's already offered for the girl, and as you hadn't made up your mind..."
She wasn't looking at Harkness. She jerked her chin urgently at one of the girls, who looked alarmed, but swiftly vanished through a door at the back.
"Gone to fetch Ned," William thought automatically,
and wondered dimly for an instant how he knew the doorkeeper's name.
"Haven't seen the colour of his money yet, have you?"
Harkness reached into his bosom and pulled out a well-stuffed wallet from which he withdrew a careless sheaf of paper money.
"I'll have her,"
he grinned unpleasantly at William,
"for the night."
William promptly whipped off his silver gorget, took the madam's hand, and pressed the crescent into it.
"For the night,"
he repeated politely, and without further ado turned and walked across the room, though the floor seemed to undulate slightly beneath his feet. He took Arabella, by the arm, and steered her toward the back door. She looked appalled. Plainly she had recognized him. But a quick glance at Captain Harkness decided her that William was the lesser of two evils, as he'd heard a sailor friend of his father's put it. He could hear Harkness's shout behind them, but just then the door opened, and a very large, tough-looking man walked in. He had but one eye, but that one focused instantly on Harkness. The man advanced on the captain, walking lightly on the balls of his feet, fists half-curled. Ex-boxer, William thought, pleased. Put that in your pipe and smoke it, Harkness. Then, a hand on the stairwell wall to stop from stumbling, he found himself following a round, agitated bum up the same worn, lye-soap-smelling stairs he had trodden yesterday, wondering what the devil he'd say to her when he reached the top. He'd been vaguely hoping that it wouldn't be the same room, but it was. It was night now, though, and the windows were open. The warmth of the day lingered in the walls and floor, but there was a breeze, spicy with tree sap, and the river's breath that made the single candle flame, flicker, and bend. The girl waited for him to come in, then closed the door, and stood with her back against it, her hands still on the knob.
"I won't hurt you," he blurted. "I didn't mean to, last time."
Her hand relaxed a bit, though she continued to look narrowly at him. It was dark where she stood, and he could barely make out the gleam of her eyes. She didn't look friendly.
"It didn't hurt me," she said. "You spoilt my best petticoat, though, and a decanter of wine. Cost me a beating, and a week's wages, that." "I'm sorry," he said. "Truly, I'll pay for the wine and the petticoat."
Using what, he wondered. It had belatedly occurred to him that the spare stockings in which he kept his cash had vanished with his orderly, and undoubtedly so had the cash. Well, he'd pawn something if he had to, or borrow a bit.
"Can't do much about the beating, but I am sorry."
She made a small huffing noise through her nose, but seemed to accept this. She took her hand off the doorknob and came a little way into the room so he could see her face in the candlelight. She was very pretty, despite the look of suspicious wariness, and he felt a mild stirring.
"Well."
She looked him up and down, much as she'd done when she met him in the alley.
"William, you said your name is?"
"Yes." The silence lengthened, a heartbeat past comfort, and he asked, almost at random,
"Is your name really Arabella?"
That surprised her, and her mouth twitched, though she didn't laugh.
"No, I'm a fancy piece, though, and Madge thinks the fancy should have names like ladies."
She raised a brow, and he wasn't sure whether she was questioning whether ladies had names like Arabella, or what he thought of Madge's philosophy.
"I do know a couple of Arabellas," he offered. "One of them's 6, and the other's 82. "Are they ladies?"
She waved a hand, dismissing the question as soon as it was asked.
"Of course they are. You wouldn't know them otherwise.
Do you want me to send for wine? Or punch?" She gave him an assessing eye.
"Only if you want to do anything, I really think you'd best stay off the drink. Your choice, though."
She put a hand to the tie of her petticoat in tepid invitation, but didn't pull it loose. Clearly she wasn't keen to induce him to do anything. He rubbed a hand over his sweating face, imagined he smelled the alcohol oozing from his pores, and wiped it on his breeches.
"I don't want wine, no. Nor do I want to do... Well, that's not true," he admitted. "I do want to. Very much," he added hurriedly, lest she think him insulting. "But I'm not going to."
She looked at him, open-mouthed. "Why not?" she said at last.
You've paid well over the odds for anything you want to do. Including buggery, if that's your pleasure.
Her lip curled a little. He flushed to the scalp.
You think I would save you from that and then do it myself?
Yes. Often men don't think of something until another mentions it, and then they're all eagerness to try it themselves. He was outraged.
You must have a most indifferent opinion of gentlemen, madam.
Her mouth twitched again, and she gave him a look of such barely veiled amusement that the blood burned in his face and ears.
Right, he said stiffly. I take your point.
Well, that's a novelty, she said, the twitch breaking into a malicious smile. It's generally the other way round. He breathed deeply through his nose.
It is meant as an apology, if you like.
It was a struggle to keep meeting her eye.
For what happened last time?
A faint breeze came in, ruffling the hair about her shoulders and filling the fabric of her shift so it billowed, which afforded him a glimpse of her nipple, like a dark rose in the candlelight. He swallowed and looked away.
My stepfather told me once that a madam of his acquaintance said to him that a night's sleep was the best gift you could give a whore.
It runs in the family, does it? Frequenting brothels? She didn't pause for a response to that.
He's right, though.
Do you really mean that you intend for me to sleep? From her tone of incredulity, he might have asked her to engage in some perversion well past buggery. He kept his temper with some difficulty.
You can sing songs or stand on your head if you prefer, madam, he said. I don't propose to molest you. Beyond that, your actions are quite up to you.
She stared at him, a small frown between her brows, and he could see that she didn't believe him.
I would go, he said, feeling awkward again. But I have some concern that Captain Harkness might still be on the premises, and should he learn that you are alone...
And he somehow couldn't face his own dark, empty room. Not tonight.
I imagine Ned's disposed of him, she said,
then cleared her throat.
But don't go. If you do, Madge will send somebody else up.
She took off her petticoat with no display of coquetry or artifice in the motion. There was a screen in the corner. She went behind this, and he heard the splash of her using a chamber pot. She came out, glanced at him, and with a brief wave at the screen said,
Just there, if you...
Thank you. He did, in fact, need to piss fairly badly, but the thought of using her pot so soon after her own use of it caused him an unreasonable amount of embarrassment.
I'll be fine.
He looked round, found a chair, and sat down in it, ostentatiously thrusting out his boots and leaning back in an attitude of relaxation. He closed his eyes, mostly. Through slitted lids, he saw her observe him closely for a moment. Then she leaned over and blew out the candle. Ghost-like in the darkness, she climbed into her bed. The ropes creaked with her weight and drew up the quilt. A faint sigh came to him over the sounds of the brothel below.
Arabella?
He didn't expect thanks exactly, but he did want something from her.
What?
She sounded resigned, obviously expecting him to say that he'd changed his mind about buggery.
What's your real name?
There was silence for a minute as she made up her mind. There was nothing tentative about the young woman, though, and when she did reply, it was without reluctance.
Jane. Oh. Just the one thing more. My coat?
I sold it.
Good night, then.
There was a prolonged moment filled with the unspoken thoughts of two people, then a deep, exasperated sigh.
Come and get into bed, you idiot.
He couldn't get into bed in full uniform.
He did keep his shirt on, with some idea of preserving her modesty in his original intent. He lay quite rigid beside her, trying to envision himself as the tomb figure of a crusader, a marble monument to noble behaviour, sworn to a chastity enforced by his stone embodiment. Unfortunately, it was a rather small bed, and William was rather large, and Arabella, Jane, wasn't trying at all to avoid touching him. Granted, she wasn't trying to arouse him either, but her mere presence did that without half trying. He was intensely aware of every inch of his body, and which of them were in contact with hers. He could smell her hair, a faint scent of soap mingled with the sweetness of tobacco smoke. Her breath was sweet, too, with the smell of burnt rum, and he wanted to taste it in her mouth, share the lingering stickiness. He closed his eyes and swallowed. Only the fact that he needed desperately to pee made it possible to keep his hands off her. He was in that state of drunkenness where he could perceive a problem, but couldn't analyze a solution to it, and sheer inability to think of two things at once prevented him either speaking to her or laying a hand on her.
"What's the matter?" she whispered hoarsely. "You're wiggling like you've got tadpoles in your drawers. Only you haven't any drawers on, have you?"
She giggled, and her breath tickled his ear. He groaned softly.
"Here now."
Her voice took on a tone of alarm, and she sat up in bed, twisting round to look at him.
"You're not going to be sick in my bed. Get up! Get up, right this minute!"
She pushed at him with small, urgent hands, and he stumbled out of bed, swaying and clutching at furniture to keep from falling. The window gaped before him, open to the night, a lovely sickle moon pale above. Taking this as the celestial invitation it surely was, he raised his shirt, gripped the window frame, and pissed into the night in a majestically arching rush of blinding bliss. The sense of relief was so intense that he noticed nothing whatever in its wake, until Arabella Jane seized him by the arm and pulled him away from the window.
"Get out of sight, for God's sake!"
She risked a hasty glance downward, then dodged back, shaking her head.
"Oh, well, it's not as though Captain Harkness was ever going to propose you for membership in his favourite club, is it?"
"Harkness?"
William swayed toward the window, blinking. There was a remarkable amount of shouting and abuse coming from below, but he was having trouble in focusing his eyes and perceived nothing save the flicker of red uniforms, redder still in the light from the lantern over the establishment's door.
"Never mind. You likely think I did it," Arabella Jane said, a dark note in her voice.
"You're a girl," William pointed out logically. "You couldn't piss out a window."
"Not without making a prime spectacle of myself, no," she agreed. "But 'tisn't unknown for a whore to throw the contents of her chamber pot out on someone, accidental on purpose."
"Well," she shrugged, went behind the screen, and emerged with the aforementioned receptacle, which she promptly upended out the open window. In response to renewed howls from below, she leaned out and shrieked several insults that a regimental sergeant would have been proud to author, before ducking back in and banging the shutters closed.
"May as well be hanged, or buggered, for a sheep as a lamb," she remarked, taking him by the arm again. "Come back to bed."
"It's only in Scotland that they bugger sheep," William said, obediently following her. "And maybe part of Yorkshire. Northumbria too, maybe."
"Oh, really? Is Captain Harkness from one of those places, then?"
"Oh, him."
William sat down on the bed rather suddenly as the room had begun to revolve in a stately manner round him.
"No. I'd say maybe Devon from his speech," he concluded, pleased to have found the word.
"So they've got sheep in Devon too, then, I suppose."
Arabella Jane was unbuttoning his shirt. He raised the hand to stop her, wondered why he should, and left the hand hanging in midair.
"Lot of sheep," he said. "Lot of sheep. Everywhere in England.
"God save the Queen, then," she murmured, intent on her work.
The last button came free, and a faint draught of air stirred the hairs on William's chest. He remembered then why he should have been stopping her, but she'd put her head inside the open front of his shirt and licked his nipple before he could make his arrested hand complete its motion. And when he did, it merely settled gently on her head, which was surprisingly warm. So was her breath. So was her hand, which had wrapped itself around his prick in a possessive sort of way.
"No," he said, after what seemed a very long time, but could have been no more than seconds.
His hand descended and closed, regretfully, over hers where it grasped him.
I meant it. I won't bother you.
She didn't let go, but did sit up and regard him with an air of puzzled impatience, just visible in the lantern light that seeped through the shutters.
"If you bother me, I'll tell you to stop. How's that?" she offered. "No," he repeated.
He was concentrating fiercely now. It seemed exceedingly important that she understand.
"Honour. It's my honour."
She made a small sound that might have been impatience or amusement.
"Maybe you should have considered your honour before you came to a whorehouse. Or did someone drag you inside against your will?"
"I came with a friend," he said with dignity.
She still hadn't let go, but couldn't move her hand, not with his clasped tightly around it.
"That's not what I mean. I mean..."
The words that had come easily a moment before had slipped away again, leaving him blank.
"You could tell me later. Once you've had a good think," she suggested.
And he was startled to discover that she had two hands and knew what to do with the other one, too.
"Unhand my... damn, what is the bloody word? Unhand my testicles, if you please, madam."
"Just as you like," she replied crisply. And, doing so, put her head back inside his damp, smelly shirt, seized one nipple between her teeth, and sucked so hard that it pulled every last word out of his head. Matters thereafter were unsettled, but largely pleasant, though at one point he found himself rearing above her, sweat dripping from his face onto her breasts, muttering,
"I'm a bastard, I'm a bastard, I'm a bastard, don't you understand?"
She didn't reply to this, but stretched up a long white arm, cupped her hand round the back of his head, and pulled him down again.
"That's why."
He came gradually to himself, aware that he was talking, and evidently had been for some time, in spite of his head being cradled in the curve of her shoulder, his senses aswim in her musk. "Like a sweating flower," he thought dreamily. And her nipple, a dark, sweet thing, an inch or two from his nose.
"The only honour I have left is my word. Have to keep it."
Then tears came suddenly to his eyes with recollection of the moments just past.
"Why did you make me break my word?"
She didn't answer for a while, and he would have thought she'd fallen asleep, save for the hand that roved over his bare back, gentle as a whisper.
"Ever think that maybe a whore has a sense of honour too?" she said at last.
Frankly, he hadn't, and opened his mouth to say so. But once more, his words had gone missing. He closed his eyes and fell asleep on her breast. Chapter 19. Desperate Measures. Sylvia Hardman stood regarding Jamie with a lowered brow, her lips pushed out in concentration. Finally she shook her head, sighed, and drew herself up.
"Thee means it, I suppose?"
"I do, friend Sylvia. I must be in Philadelphia as quickly as maybe. And to do that, I must reach the road. I must be able to walk tomorrow morning, however haltingly.
Well, then. Patience, fetch me thy father's special flask. And Prudence, will thee grind a good measure of mustard seed?
She stepped a little closer to the bed, peering near-sightedly at Jamie's back, as though to gauge the acreage.
A good handful, no, make it two. My hands are small.
She took a digging stick from the shelf near the door, but hesitated before opening it.
Do not touch thy eyes or face, Prue, and by no means touch Chastity without washing thy hands first. Let Patience mind her if she cries.
Chastity was making fretful noises, though freshly fed and changed. Patience, though, had already run out the door, making Jamie wonder where her father's special flask might be. Hidden, apparently.
Put the wean beside me, he suggested. I can mind her for a bit.
Sylvia did so without hesitation, which pleased him, and he laid face to face with wee Chastity, amusing them both by making faces at her. She giggled, and so did Prudence, as the pestle scraped and the hot smell of ground mustard thickened the air. He stuck out his tongue and waggled it. Chastity shook like a small jelly, and put out a tiny pink tongue-tip in turn, which made him laugh.
"What are you all laughing at?"
Patience demanded, opening the door. She frowned censoriously from one sister to the other, making them all laugh harder. When Mrs. Hardman came in a few moments later with a large grubby root in her hand, they had reached the point of laughing at absolutely nothing, and she blinked in bewilderment, but then shook her head and smiled.
"Well, they do say laughter is good medicine," she remarked, when the hilarity had run its course, leaving the girls pink-faced, and Jamie feeling slightly better, to his surprise. "May I borrow thy knife, friend James? It is more suited to the purpose than mine."
This was patently true. Her knife was a crude iron blade, badly sharpened, the haft bound with string. Jamie had a good ivory case knife, bought in Brest, of hardened steel, with an edge that would shave the hairs off his forearm. He saw her smile with involuntary pleasure at the feel of it in her hand, and had a momentary flash of memory. Brianna, delicately unfolding a blade of her Swiss army knife, an air of pleased satisfaction on her face. Claire appreciated good tools, too, but she touched tools with immediate thought of what she meant to do with them, rather than simple admiration for elegance and function. A blade in her hand was no longer a tool, but an extension of her hand. His own hand closed, thumb rubbing gently against his fingertips, remembering the knife he had made for her, the handle carefully grooved and sanded smooth to fit her hand, to match her grip exactly. Then he closed his fist tight, not wanting to think of her so intimately. Not just now. Bidding the girls stand well back out of the way, Sylvia carefully peeled the root and grated it into a small wooden bowl, keeping her face averted as much as possible from the rising fumes of the fresh horseradish, but still with tears streaming down her face. Then wiping her eyes on her apron and taking up the special flask, this being a dark brown stoneware bottle stained with earth. Had the lass just dug it up? She cautiously poured a small amount of the very alcoholic contents. What was it? Jamie wondered, sniffing cautiously. Very old applejack? Twice fermented plum brandy? It had probably started life as some sort of fruit, but it had been some time since that fruit hung on a tree. Mrs. Hardman relaxed, putting the cork back into the bottle, as though relieved that the contents had not, in fact, exploded upon being decanted.
"Well, then," she said, coming over to pick up Chastity, who squealed and fussed at being removed from Jamie, whom she plainly regarded as a large toy. "That must steep for a few hours. Thee needs heat. Thee should sleep, if thee can. I know thee passed a wakeful night, and tonight may not be much better."
Jamie had steeled himself to the prospect of drinking horseradish liquor with a mix of trepidation and curiosity.
The first of these emotions was momentarily relieved when he discovered that Mrs. Hardman didn't mean him to drink it. But it returned in force when he found himself a moment later face down on the bed with his shirt rucked up to his oxters and his hostess vigorously rubbing the stuff into his buttocks.
"Have a care, friend Sylvia,"
he managed, trying to turn his head enough to get his mouth clear of the pillow without either twisting his back or unclenching his bum.
"If you drip that down the crack of my arse, I may be cured with a somewhat sudden violence."
A small snort of amusement tickled the hairs in the small of his back, where the flesh was still smarting and tingling from her administrations.
"My grandmother did say this receipt would raise the dead," she said, her voice pitched low in order not to disturb the girls, who were rolled up upon the hearth in their blankets like caterpillars.
"Perhaps she was less careful in her applications."
"Thee needs heat," she'd said.
Between the horseradish liniment and the mustard plaster resting on his lower back, he thought he might suffer spontaneous combustion at any moment. He was sure his skin was blistering.
"I know thee passed a wakeful night, and tonight may not be much better."
She'd got that right. He shifted, trying to turn stealthily onto his side without making noise or dislodging the plaster. She'd bound it to his lower back by means of strips of torn flannel tied round his body, but they had a tendency to slip. The pain, when shifting, was in fact much less, which encouraged him greatly. On the other hand, he felt as though someone was repeatedly passing a pine torch within inches of his body. And while she had been very careful while working the liniment into him from rib cage to knees, a bit of the ferocious liquid had touched his balls, giving him a not unpleasant sense of remarkable heat between his legs, but also an uncontrollable urge to squirm. He hadn't, while she was working on him, and hadn't said a word. Not after seeing the state of her hands, red as a lobster back's coat, and a milky blister arising on the side of her thumb. She hadn't said a word either, just drawn down his shirt when she was done, and patted him gently on the backside before going to wash, and then smoothed a little cooking grease gingerly into her hands. She was asleep now, too, a hunched form curled up in the corner of the settle, little Chastity's cradle by her foot safely away from the banked embers of the fire. Now and then one of the glowing chunks of wood split with a loud crack and a small fountain of sparks. He stretched gingerly, experimenting.
Better.
But whether he was cured in the morning or not, he was leaving, if he had to drag himself on his elbows to the road. The Hardmans must have their bed back, and he must have his.
Claire's bed.
The thought made the heat in his flesh bloom up through his belly, and he did squirm. His thoughts squirmed too, thinking of her, and he grabbed one, pinning it down like a disobedient dog.
"It's nae her fault," he thought fiercely. "She's done me nae wrong."
They'd thought him dead. Massali had told him so, and told him that Lord John had wed Claire in haste following the news of Jamie's death, in order to protect not only her, but Fergus and Massali as well, from imminent arrest.
"Aye, and then he took her to his bed."
The knuckles of his left hand twinged as he curled his fist.
"Never hit them in the face, lad."
Dougal had told him that a lifetime ago, as they watched a knock-down fight between two of Colum's men in the courtyard at Leoch.
"Hit them in the soft parts." They'd hit him in the soft parts. "Nay her fault," he muttered under his breath, turning restlessly into his pillow. What the bloody hell had happened, though? How had they done it? Why?
He felt as though he was